Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, it's the News Roundup, where we talk to area journalists about stories making headlines this week. We learned more this week about the potential causes of a deadly fire earlier this month in Fall River. The fire at the Gabriel House Assisted Living Facility killed 10 people, the highest loss of life in more than 40 years in a fire of the state. Nearly three dozen people were injured, including some firefighters. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here with that story and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Mindy.
So tell us what the investigation has found.
Well, the official cause of this fire is going to be listed as undetermined, at least for now. And that's because fire officials have to say it's undetermined whenever there are two or more causes that cannot be ruled out. But in this case, they actually know a lot about those two possible causes. They've determined there are two possible causes here. The fire started in a residence room. And the two things they're looking at are the oxygen-concentrating machine that was in the room. It could have had either an electrical or mechanical failure. And the other thing is smoking materials. The investigators said there were numerous smoking materials in the room. And regardless of which one of those things actually was the immediate cause of this fire, the investigators say that medical oxygen in the building in general played a significant role in the fire spreading rapidly in this building. From what I've been learning, the oxygen itself doesn't explode, but because fire needs oxygen and feeds on it, that can make a fire more likely to ignite, more likely to burn hotter and spread.
Ugh, so quickly, too. So what are local and state authorities doing to prevent something like this from happening again?
Well, the state has an assisted living commission, which is actually a new thing. It was established in state law and then actually started up earlier this year prior to the fire. And that commission is going to be making recommendations on health and safety issues in assisted living. So they were originally due to make those recommendations in August, but now because of this fire, they have been given more time to make sure that any lessons learned from the Fall River fire are going to be incorporated into their report.
Maybe no smoking would be one of the. So what about the response? Some people have suggested that Fall River did not have enough firefighters before this fire.
That's right. The International Association of Firefighters, which is the firefighters union in the U.S. and Canada, said that Fall River does not meet the national standard for four firefighters per truck. That standard is something set by the National Fire Protection Association. The union, according to the union, Fall River had only two of its 10 fire companies were staffed at that level. Otherwise, they were operating with three people in a truck. The city says it's now going to increase that to four on all of the engine companies. That's a specific thing, not every fire truck, but the engine companies. At first, they're going to be using overtime for that. But the chief says they're also working with the city on a plan to hire some more firefighters so that they can do that without overtime. I wanted to note here, because I wondered immediately, what does New Bedford have? New Bedford says they are staffing all their engine and ladder companies with four firefighters already. But I know that many, many communities in Massachusetts do not. Fall River is certainly not an outlier in that.
Now, Governor Healey said Fall River is going to be getting some state money to hire more firefighters. And where's that money coming from?
Well, it's not new money, right? It's not like the administration just decided to give Fall River some money on the spur of the moment because this happened. But what Healey said is that she's going to be speeding up the award of $1.2 million to Fall River from a grant program that was already operating. The applications for that were not due until August. But this is a grant program for public safety personnel in communities that meet certain criteria. There are only 10 of them. They have to have a population of at least 60,000 and a relative $60,000. I'm sorry. A population of 60,000 and a relatively small police budget. So Fall River is one of the communities that meets the criteria for those grants.
Yeah. In the meantime, 59 survivors really facing uncertainty. The Globe has a story this morning that they're, scattered about. They don't know where they're going to live next. They don't even have their belongings back. They're in facilities from Fall River all the way down to South Yarmouth. So, tough times still, uncertain times for those survivors. Shifting to some news on the Cape bridges, the state held its latest public meeting on the bridge replacement project Monday. What's new here? Has anything changed?
Well, we learned that some of the federal grant money that has been promised to Massachusetts for the Sagamore Bridge has finally arrived. It's actually not a big number, $36 million out of about $1.7 billion overall federal dollars committed to this project. But Louisa Pywonski, who is leading this project for the State Department of Transportation, says that the state asked for that money to be issued to them to use in the work that they're doing as they prepare to file their state and federal environmental permit applications, which is a big document, a big process. And she says that then that money was dispersed to them promptly. So for her, this is a sign that things are proceeding normally. She says it's not unusual to kind of get the money in stages like that. But one thing that I think definitely caught people's eye is there's a kind of like two really high profile transportation projects in Massachusetts right now. One is the Cape Bridges. The other one is replacing the I-90 viaduct in Alston. And that project just had the majority of its federal money clawed back by the Trump administration. But Pywonski says that that money was rescinded for a specific reason, which is that project is considered to be equity related because it's trying to undo the running of the highway through a disadvantaged neighborhood. For better or worse, the bridges are a separate project.
And at the bridge meeting this week, there was a notable presence of business and nonprofit leaders from the Cape speaking in support of the bridge replacement project. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we've heard a lot in the past from individual residents, you know, who are upset about losing their homes, obviously. Others have spoken in support of the bridges. But this time there was really a noticeable contingent of people speaking on behalf of their organizations about how vital it is to them to replace the bridges. Remember, repairing the bridges, as Senator Dylan Fernandez said that night, would require a shutdown for an extended period. He said that it would require a bridge to be shut down completely for 9 months.
Whoa. Completely. We have to imagine like that. Nine months. Bridge closed completely.
Wow. 9 months. And then after that, a single lane for 2 years.
What a traffic nightmare.
Yes. So the business people were speaking out against that a possibility. There were folks there from the Chamber, the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce, the Falmouth Chamber of Commerce, Davenport Companies, the Heritage Museums and Gardens. District Attorney Rob Galloboy spoke as well about the difficulty of getting employees and witnesses over the bridge. Another speaker there was Bert Tallerman. He is president of Cape Cod 5. And he said the idea of failing to replace those bridges on time keeps him up at night.
A closure of either one of these bridges is just a complete economic disaster for this region in ways and shapes that people can't even begin to imagine, that extend significantly beyond even the studies that have been done.
You know, they also brought up how many employees going both ways, people who come to the Cape to work and also those on the Cape who go to the other side of the bridge to work. So this would be just such a nightmare. We also know that 13 homeowners and a few businesses are slated to lose their property to eminent domain for the Sagamore Bridge. What's the status of those properties right now?
Well, the appraisal of those properties is underway. People have had the appraisers visiting their properties. That is a lengthy process. So they have at least two appraisals, and then there, if the if the property value is over a certain amount, there's an additional review. Residents continue to speak up at these meetings about how they don't want to lose their homes. You know, the trauma of it and the concern that the state's promise to make them whole, to give them something comparable to what they have. Many of them say that it's completely unrealistic to think that there's a property on Cape Cod that will match what they have, which for some of them is a water view of the canal. One resident brought up a request that we actually haven't heard much about before. She called for mental health support for the stress of this eminent domain and relocation process. That was Joan Hendel. She lives in the Round Hill neighborhood by the Sagamore Bridge.
Could you please tell me where in that whole list you have wanted allocation for mental health support? Because each one of us that live in Round Hill, when your team comes out in their cars and they stand in our driveways with seven people, doing appraisals, it puts us over the edge. And unless you've been there, you don't understand.
So she and some others, right, were...
Yeah, they asked for a more specific timeline, some of them did, about when they will have to leave. The state said that the reason they haven't given a more specific timeline is that the requirements for what they have to find people to replace their house are so stringent that it can take time. And then people have different desires. Some want to stay as long as possible in their homes. Others, if they have to leave, want to do it as soon as possible. And as I said before, that appraisal process is very detailed. It goes through multiple steps.
Yeah, you can't help but feel for those folks who are losing their homes. Yeah, it's very difficult. CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Thanks, Jeanette.
Thanks, Mindy.
No shortage of shark news this week. We had a great white shark named Contender that was tagged by OSearch researchers off of Nantucket. This was the largest male great white tagged by OSearch in the western North Atlantic, measuring nearly 14 feet and over 600 pounds. We also had a story about the increasing number of smooth hammerhead sharks being spotted by fishermen and recreational boaters. Experts say while there have always been some, the increasing numbers can be attributed to warming water temperatures. You can check out more details on both these stories at our website, capeandislands.org. A species of shark we don't often hear a lot about are sandbar sharks. Caroline Kaltos grew up spending summers on Nantucket. Now, as a PhD candidate at UMass Boston, working with the New England Aquarium, she spends her days on the island researching sandbar sharks. And CAI's Gilda Geis spoke to Caroline to learn more about the sandbar shark and her work, and here's their conversation.
Caroline, great white sharks tend to get a lot of attention around here, understandably so, but your research is focused on sandbar sharks. So can you kind of like introduce us to the sandbar shark and tell us a little bit about how they fit into our region's ecosystem?
Oh, I'd love to. So sandbar sharks are your typical looking shark. They come up to the Nantucket, Cape, and Islands area in the summer. They usually show up around mid-June when the water temperature is to their liking. And they stay around our islands and our area throughout the summer, and then they'll migrate down south in the winter down to the South Carolina area. This species gets to be about 7 feet long. Their main prey is bluefish, fluke, striper. They'll eat a lot of eel, actually. We catch them on eel sometimes. And they play an important role in monitoring and maintaining those bony fish populations, whereas we get a lot of white sharks here that are going for seals. So that can be a large difference between the species. And actually, a full-grown sandbar shark could be prey to a full-grown white shark. They're actually not really a large threat to humans at all. They've never been affiliated in an unprovoked attack.
Are you casting your fishing rod into the ocean and like waiting for these guys to bite?
Yes, and I will reel them in myself. Not all the time, but I'll do it. We put a piece of bluefish on a hook, throw it out. We'll be pretty close to shore. Sometimes I fish from the beach. Sometimes I fish from the boat, depending on what tag I'm putting out and what method I need to follow for my data. Shark fishing can be really fun or really boring because you just kind of wait around sometimes, waiting for the shark to find the bait and take the hook successfully. And then once they do that, we reel them in to either the shoreline or we bring them to the side of the boat. If they're beside the boat, I restrain them with ropes so that they're safe and I'm safe during the handling process. I handle them for 3 to 4 minutes and then I release them with their tags.
What is the goal of your research with these sandbar sharks?
Yeah, so I actually spent a lot of my childhood and years growing up on Nantucket, and I noticed in like 2018, 2019 that we were seeing a lot more sandbar sharks. So I really wanted to kind of monitor the who, what, when, where, and whys of this species. When are they here? What sizes are we seeing? What sexes are we seeing? Why are they using this area? Is it primarily for suitable habitat that they can find food and forage and have refuge from predators? Are they here for mating? The species was heavily overfished up until the 80s and 90s and early 2000s when they changed regulations so that the species could not be commercially and recreationally kept. You can still fish for it recreationally, but you must release the species. So we started seeing this population rebound a couple decades later because sharks are so slow to grow and take so long to reproduce. So it's clearly an important area for this species. And it's also the most northern range of their habitat. So as we have more waters warming, we might see them venturing north. And it was kind of like important for me to create this baseline of data to figure out why this area is important so that if we do see changes in the future, we can actually address those changes and point to them with scientific evidence and data.
Do you have any like favorite sandbar shark fun facts?
Yeah, so they give live birth. Not every shark species does that, but sandbar sharks are born the same way kind of humans are, with a placenta. They can get to be over 30 years old in the wild, so they can't reproduce until they're about 15 years old. There's also no parental care in any shark species. So a baby sandbar shark can be eaten by its own larger relative or mom if they come across each other at any point in time after birth. I have some of my favorite sandbar sharks that I've tagged, and some of them have been coming back to Nantucket for about 5 or 6 years now every summer. I consider those my like most valuable sharks, my MVSs of my study.
Do they have names?
Yeah. So we have Cosmo, we have Callie, Cinnamon Bun, Oregano, Eugenie, Buzz Aldrin, Clarence Carter. When you get over 200 of them, you can really start coming up with a lot of names.
That's Caroline Kalaitos, shark researcher and PhD candidate with UMass Boston and the New England Aquarium. Caroline, thanks so much.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
And coming up after a break, fascination with a large rock in Orleans and a barrier beach bill on Beacon Hill could have repercussions on the vineyard. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point and the Weekly News Roundup. Vice President J.D. Vance was on Nantucket for a fundraiser where he was met with some protesters. Josh Balling from the Inquirer and Mirror joins us. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
So this was a fundraiser that had a hefty price tag.
It did. As they tend to do, the presidential and campaign fundraisers have quite big price tags. This one was about $150,000 to $250,000 ahead for most of the ticket holders. And according to the New York Post, Vance's visit raised about $3 million for
wow.
the Republican National Committee. But it wasn't without some controversy, I wouldn't call it, but certainly some protest. The second family landed at Nantucket Memorial Airport just before noon on Tuesday. They were quickly taken by a motorcade from the airport. They were seen out boating in the afternoon before the dinner at a home just off Cliff Road. But as they were driving to that fundraising dinner, both sides of the road were packed with about 200 protesters who booed the motorcade as it went by, and there were quite a few people waving signs. There was also a rally earlier in the day at Children's Beach that was attended by a couple hundred people. And all this was organized by the Nantucket chapter of Indivisible, with help from some of the other Indivisible groups on the Cape and some other mainland political action groups. They also hosted Cape Cod resident Amanda McGonigal, mm-hmm. who runs the viral Instagram account Cats on a Couch, which has about 1 million followers. So she was encouraging her followers to join that rally at Children's Beach. But the day went off without incident. It caused a lot of traffic snafus as the motorcade was rolling through the middle of the island into some other places. But security was fairly tight. There was a fairly large state police contingent motorcycle unit here, as well as Nantucket police and state troopers. And there was a small counter-protest, I guess you could call it. A few Trump and Republican campaign supporters drove down Cliff Road while the protesters were on both sides of the street, waving American flags and honking. But no incidents were reported, and no real disruption on the day on one of the busier days of the summer. But we're not unfamiliar with political fundraisers out here for both parties. The Clintons have been here. President Trump was here prior to his first election as president. There's potentially a lot of money to be made from our well-heeled summer residents for the politicians of all stripes.
For sure. All right. Another story you have this week. Federal cuts are gutting the ELL programs. And this is, there's a lot of students, I would think, who are taking part in those English learning programs.
There are a lot of students. And fortunately, we've found out that the federal funding that Nantucket receives for its ELL programs does not cover teacher salaries, does not cover curriculum materials or supplies. It's mostly supplemental funding for continued learning for the educators themselves. So it could have been a lot worse. But the schools did find out this week that they're losing about at least $50,000 to $52,000 in federal grant funding. that they were going to use for professional development through the Massachusetts Association of Teachers of Speakers of Other Languages Conference, that kind of stuff. And Superintendent Beth Hallett said that while this is disappointing, the schools will figure out a way to continue the programming for the faculty. But it's part of a much larger issue, obviously.
Right.
The governor's office sent out a release earlier in the week that over $100 million in federal education funds for Massachusetts schools are being withheld across the board.
Yeah, and you know, school budgets are so tight, but it does look like they're going to be able to continue the programs, finding the money somewhere else.
They will, and it's not really going to impact the students, fortunately, because we do have about 50% of the student body at Nantucket High School does not list English as their first language, especially when they get here. So ELL has, you know, taken on a much larger significance over the last decade or so in the Nantucket school system.
All right. Thanks, Josh Bolling from the Inquirer and Mirror. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
A landscape piece in Orleans is creating a lot of buzz. Why so much fascination with a rock? Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us with the answer. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Mindy.
All right, so what's the deal with this rock?
Well, it's a big rock. It was dug up while the town was working on a sewer installation right in front of the Staples Plaza right in the center of Orleans. And instead of just, demolishing or removing the rock, they decided to make it a feature of the landscape. And for some reason, it's become a viral meme, on social media. It's blown up. People go take selfies with it. People have photoshopped all sorts of interesting things in it. And it's really become a thing.
Yeah. And there's selling souvenirs and things about at that particular Staples, right?
Yeah,
and T-shirts.
Only at the Orleans Staples, which is the rock Staples. They're capitalizing on this, and they recently started selling T-shirts and bags and hats and other sort of merchandise with the rock on it. And some of them have the inscription, "I visited scenic Staples Rock." They're really, they've got a separate little area in the store now for that. And they said that, we were told that the merchandise is selling pretty well. And, it's not likely to go any further than Orleans. It's kind of a local thing. But, it's kind of fun. It's a summer thing.
Yeah.
I think it's got people talking and giving some life to that part of town a little bit.
Yeah, it's funny because you just never know what will go viral. So whether this remains a temporary fascination or not, I guess, remains to be seen, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's a rock. They can always move it or take it away.
Yeah. On a more serious note, food insecurity, a serious issue facing many, and things could get worse with upcoming cuts to SNAP benefits. Governor Healey paid a visit to the food pantry in Harwich this week. What did she have to say?
So Governor Healey was basically promoting a new anti-hunger task force that she created last week through an executive order. And that group's goal is to help fill short-term funding gaps in the hunger safety net around the state. They'll be looking for ways to do that, both short and long-term, actually. And, to combat some of those federal cuts, Governor Healey noted during her visit that more than 800 families every week visit the family pantry in Harwich.
Yeah.
That's a lot of families.
You look at the food pantries across the Cape and islands, for that matter, and boy, numbers are really up. Yeah.
The numbers are up. State Senator Julian Sear, who was there on Tuesday, noted that 34% of Cape Codders and Islanders face some sort of food insecurity. That's a big percentage.
Yeah.
And the family pantry has been working to not only, increase availability. They're obviously worried about what's going to happen with either an increase in clients because of the SNAP cuts, but also with cuts to food funding programs. They rely on the Greater Boston Food Bank for a lot of their groceries, and that's being cut back. And so they're trying to figure out how to combat that. And one of the things the governor highlighted was a couple of the local programs that the family pantry has in partnership with local fishing organizations, the Cape Cod Commercial Fisheries Association and the Chatham Harvesters both collaborate with the pantry to make locally caught seafood and chowder available to their clients, which helps everybody. You know, helps the fishermen, it helps the clients to get some nice fresh protein.
Yeah.
And these are the kind of things I think the governor is interested in promoting to try to counter the right. The cuts and all those things.
Yeah. Harwich Select Board wanting a review of the regional school agreement. This is typically happens what every so often, every 5 years or something like that, right?
They're required to review this the Monomoy District School agreement every 5 years, and it's time to do that. But the selectmen in Harwich have been clamoring for a number of years now to revisit the funding formula that's in the agreement, because they feel that, you know, Harwich, which has 74% of the students and therefore pays 74% of the budget, they say that's unsustainable for the town, and they'd like some sort of revision to that. And that's going to be the focus, really, of this upcoming review between, you know, the school committee is going to be starting to look at that. They were actually starting to look at it yesterday. They were scheduled to do that. And Chatham is going to have to be folded in on the process. So it's probably going to take a little while, but, you know, we'll be certainly following that pretty closely, because it's got some significant impacts to local funding, local taxes, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Mindy.
CAI's Gilda Geis spoke with our State House reporter, Katie Lannon, recently to get the latest from Beacon Hill. And here's their conversation.
Governor Maura Healey is launching a new anti-hunger task force out of concern that federal spending cuts will impact local food assistance programs. So what is the outlook for these food assistance programs right now and for those who rely on them?
There's going to be major changes, it looks like, to the food assistance programs, such as SNAP. Under the budget bill that President Trump signed into law recently, the advocates on the ground here have been projecting that up to 175,000 SNAP recipients could lose some or all of their benefits just in Massachusetts. There is a change to the cost-sharing mechanism between the states and federal government that will put Massachusetts on the hook for probably tens of millions of dollars more in added costs. Some other changes could cost the state hundreds of millions of dollars more potentially, and that's money that the governor says that the state's tight budget can't absorb. And at the same time, a lot of the people who rely on food assistance programs also use programs like Medicaid, where they might also be facing benefits changes or losing benefits there. So food banks have really been warning that the impact could be bigger than it looks like, that families struggle with the decision of, well, do I buy food or do I pay my medical bills?
What will the task force be doing to help address hunger in the state?
This task force is looking at how to mitigate the impact of those funding cuts in the near term, the immediate things that the state can do, including in collaboration with other northeastern states across New England and New York. But they're also, according to the executive order that Governor Healey signed, going to be looking for long-term sustainable solutions to tackle hunger statewide, preserving food systems and helping out local economies. They'll be looking for public-private partnerships, data-driven reforms, and different things state agencies can do.
Moving on to another story from the State House this week, health insurance premiums in Massachusetts are set to go up from 7 to 12% next year. Why?
Yeah, this is in the merged market for healthcare. So that's folks who have plans there, individuals and small businesses, about 400,000 people across the state. And the increases there are the product of a negotiation between state regulators and the insurers. And the Healey administration, even though these numbers sound pretty big, 7 to 12%, is touting them as a win because they've negotiated these down and actually rejected two proposed increases that they said were too big. That's under a new law that the governor signed earlier this year that gives the insurance commissioner new power to consider affordability when reviewing insurance rates. That's part of a law that put in a lot of new safeguards across the healthcare system in response to the Steward healthcare crisis and other efforts to make sure healthcare stays affordable and accessible to people here in Massachusetts.
As you mentioned, this increase is actually less than what insurance companies requested from the state's Division of Insurance. So how much higher did these companies want premiums to go up, and what was their reasoning?
It varies across the insurers, but they were seeking an average of a more than 13% increase. So the insurers say that that reflects the costs that they're on the hook for on the medical and pharmaceutical side. They say it's getting more and more expensive. And this is something the state has been grappling with for years. There is a benchmark, a healthcare cost growth target under state law that is supposed to limit the increases in healthcare costs every year. But even with that law in place, care across the spectrum is getting more and more expensive, burdening families and employers. And it's something that policymakers continue to look for solutions for, but haven't unlocked just yet.
That's Katie Lannon reporting from the State House. Katie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's CAI's Gilda Geist talking to Katie Lannon. Some vineyarders are watching legislation regarding barrier beaches and great ponds and the impact it could have there. Ethan Gettner from the Vineyard Gazette has more on that. Hi, Ethan.
Hi, Mindy.
So tell us a little bit about this legislation.
So this is a bill filed by Governor Maura Healey last month that, you know, it does a lot of things. So it's an environmental bond bill, $3 billion, but kind of the thing a lot of people here are looking at is this provision that has to do with barrier beaches and great ponds. So here on the Vineyard and a lot of other places, there are great ponds. There are ponds that are larger than 10 acres, and a lot of them have kind of a beach that separates the pond from the ocean. Currently, that land is usually held in by private homeowners, and this bill seeks to kind of change the way that works.
And what's interesting here that I am trying to, it's confusing, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's, I'm wondering if it's private land, and there's this argument that if these swaths of beach are taken by the state, it could take the property off the town tax rolls and result in higher taxes. But, and I know you don't know the answer to this question, but I wonder if the question there is will the state be taking that by eminent domain? And if they do, don't they have to pay fair market value for that beach property, which you would think would be a lot of money, right?
Yeah, I mean, so that's kind of at the heart of this. There's a lot of confusion and kind of debate over this. So what the state is proposing is, you know, if that private land eventually gets moved into a great pond, say by erosion or whatever, that becomes the property of the state. That currently happens right now, but the way it works now also is if that is the sand shift, if they go on to, say, I have a property and they go on to my property, that sand is now mine. Mm-hmm. What the state is arguing now, what it wants to do is once it goes into the great pond and it becomes property of the state, no matter where it goes after that. So, like you said, a lot of people are saying that's land, you're taking our land. That's a taking. You can't do that. And so a lot of folks who are watching this are saying, you know, this is going to kind of result in, you know, kind of litigation all over the state.
Yeah, because I definitely you can see the litigation coming. And this is what, there's 16 great ponds on the Vineyard. So this is impacting quite a bit of territory, right?
Yeah, and there's quite a few on Cape Cod as well. I mean, our South Shore is kind of littered with great ponds, which is all kind of prized beach area here as well. And, you know, usually the people who have those beaches like owning those beaches, mm-hmm. and a lot of them have the money to defend it. So it'll be interesting to kind of see how this bill kind of moves forward. It's something that the state has looked at for a long time, since I think going back to 2011.
Yeah. So, and this is, and some folks are having an issue with it being into an environmental bond bill. Is that right?
Yeah, there's, you know, bond bills in Massachusetts are usually used, you know, this is saying you can borrow money for this priority. There's no money attached to this. So they're kind of saying, why is this in this bill? And a lot of other people are questioning, there's a man out here, Richard Friedman, a prominent real estate developer in Cambridge. He owns a large estate on one of the great ponds out here, big Maura Healey supporter and donator. So people are kind of questioning, you know, is this a situation where she's just trying to help out a funder?
Yeah. She says no, though.
Yeah, she's saying this is all about beach access. She says we got a statement from her. She said, you know, growing up in New Hampshire on the seacoast, kind of access to beach is something near and dear to her heart. And Massachusetts does have some of the strictest beach access laws in the country.
Yeah. Maine and Massachusetts.
Yep.
Another story you have, 9 swimmers heading into the water on Nantucket and swimming to the Vineyard. That is not an easy swim.
That is not an easy swim, and it's been tried, again, several times. It's something, the guy behind it, his name is Doug McConnell. He's been attempting this. He attempted this 3 other times, and it's difficult. There's he's swam the English Channel. He's swam the Catalina Channel. He's looped around Manhattan. So this is a guy who knows what he's doing, but it's something that's difficult the way the currents are and the tides run. No one's ever done it before. And so after several attempts to do it solo, he this year teamed up with, like you said, 8 other folks. And they did it on Tuesday. They finally did it.
Team of 8 other folks hoping maybe somebody would make it, right? And all 9 of them. And, you know, I think a lot of people are going, wait, what about the sharks? But it's not just sharks. It's currents. It's jellyfish. And did they encounter any problems at all? Or was it a good day to do that?
From I think what we gather, yeah, it was pretty good. They time it. They look at these things. They're kind of monitoring when they do this. I think last year they were trying when they attempted to do it, it got called off because of the weather. So this isn't they don't just kind of willy nilly kind of go into the water.
Yeah.
It's something that they kind of are always checking, kind of how the currents are going and things like that. And this was all for personal pride, but also to raise money for ALS. And the YMCA out here.
Yeah, and the money going to the Y is for the Learn to Swim program, which of course is very important.
Yeah, here on the Vineyard, it's not a bad skill to have.
Yeah. All right, Ethan Gettner from the Vineyard Gazette. As always, thank you, Ethan.
Thank you, Mindy.
Coming up after break, how stress is landing some in the dentist chair. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point, and it's the weekly news roundup. Access to sexual health programs are threatened by the Trump administration's proposed budget cuts. According to Tyler Yeager of the Provincetown Independent, the Outer Cape is already feeling the impacts. CAI's Gilda Geis spoke with Tyler to learn more about the future of sexual health care on the Outer Cape.
Let's start with the recent Supreme Court decision regarding sexual health care access. What are the impacts of that ruling?
Supreme Court ruling is the decision called Kennedy v. Braidwood Management. So that's Robert F. Kennedy, the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And the ruling preserved requirements that originally were provisions of the Affordable Care Act for insurance companies to cover some preventive services at no cost to patients. Services are determined by a task force in the Health and Human Services Department, and they include pre-exposure prophylaxis drugs, which are critical to preventing HIV transmission with a really high effectiveness rate. So it was to preserve access to those drugs and require insurance companies to cover them under most plans for free to patients.
How do proposed funding cuts at the state and federal level threaten sexual health programs on the Outer Cape?
This is an important part of the kind of irony, right, of both this provision getting preserved and also the fact that President Trump, in his first term, started a program called Ending the HIV Epidemic that allocated a very large chunk of money that's now getting proposed to be cut for HIV and STI prevention. The way that translates to the Outer Cape is largely through the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. That department receives a very large award of $9 million that it uses for core HIV prevention and surveillance efforts, and that means things like outreach, education, getting access to preventive care like PrEP, and helping local health departments do contact tracing and field epidemiology around the state. And, you know, that's really critical money. We have heard for organizations out here like Outer Cape Health Services, as well as AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod. Outer Cape Health Services has told us that their STI prevention program funding from the Department of Public Health in Massachusetts is already slated to be reduced by 10% next fiscal year. And for AIDS Support Group, they've already had to shelve a few programs that they were expecting either to continue or expand in the next year, including two positions for harm reduction specialists, a program to expand their needle exchange to the rest of the Outer Cape, which is often a really crucial aspect of HIV prevention, and their monkeypox vaccination programs, which they are able to do with support both from the state and with support from a CDC grant that has expired of about $800,000.
The state's Department of Public Health Commissioner, Robert Goldstein, spoke to The Independent for this story. So what was his outlook on the situation?
Commissioner Goldstein was pretty clear that these funding cuts are going to have a real effect on DPH's budget. Some of them do go to Suffolk County in particular because it's a site of a higher rate of HIV infection. But the funding that's supposed to be used across the state includes things like performing integrated HIV syphilis tests, community health centers, getting linkage to mental health and substance use treatment, creating programs for community health centers do appointment reminders and screenings for patients who may be eligible for PrEP prescription. Those are going to have real effects. And overall, not just for HIV prevention, federal funding comprises nearly half of DPH's budget. So those grants are really critical for public health in Massachusetts.
Is there anything else you wanted to add?
You know, one surprising aspect of the story, we were reporting on it and getting in numbers, is that the state has also dropped its financial support for HIV prevention locally. The line item for prevention services has dropped about 10% over the last 2 years. And advocates like Sean Cahill of the Fenway Institute have said, given what's happening at the federal level, that amount of funding should be raised in part to anticipate these federal cuts, or at least kept to what it was two fiscal years ago. That's something that our state Senator Julian Sierra supported, but did not pass the budget conference committee process this year.
That's Tyler Jaeger of the Provincetown Independent. Tyler, thanks so much.
Thank you, Gilda.
There is a lot going on in the world right now, and all that, plus the challenges of day-to-day life, can add up to a lot of stress. And while we all process stress in different ways, reporter Craig Lamolt found it landed him, of all places, in the dentist's chair, and he is not alone.
We're going to give you some time to get it good and numb.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
So I'm in the dentist's office now, getting a little numb here, because I'm getting not one, but two crowns on my teeth, because I broke two teeth because I've been grinding them at night.
My dentist, Dr. Lena Al-Aswad, says she's seen a lot of this recently.
I mean, we've been seeing increased cases of fractured teeth to stress and grinding.
To be clear, I don't actually feel all that stressed out in my daily life, but apparently I'm working everything out in my sleep. Dr. Al-Aswad's comment got me wondering if other dentists are seeing more of this kind of thing, too. A quick search online brings up a survey by the American Dental Association from March of 2021. It said 70% of dentists who responded then saw an increase in teeth grinding and clenching. But remember, back then was the height of the pandemic, so stress levels were off the charts. So I asked Dr. Al-Aswad about that.
Did you see an increase during the pandemic?
I'm actually seeing it more this year.
Yeah.
I'm seeing it more I don't know what's going on, but I'm seeing. But it's the thing is, it takes some time. So people have been stressed for a couple of years, and they've been, you know, grinding their teeth, and now the outcome of that is fracturing teeth.
To see if there is a bigger trend going on right now, I asked the Massachusetts Dental Society. And their president, Dr. Stephen Spitz, thought it was a good question.
So we were able to put together a survey and just asking dentists, is this something that you're also noticing? Because certainly in my practice, I've been noticing many more people grinding their teeth.
Over the last month, 140 Massachusetts dentists responded to the survey. And sure enough,
over 75% noticed, yeah, we're definitely seeing more grinding and clenching. More than 65% said, yeah, we're seeing more cracked teeth and chipped teeth. Also, headaches is another sign of clenching and grinding. And that is also in those numbers.
Dr. Gabriella LaGreca is a prosthodontist and associate professor at Tufts University School of Dental Medicine. She says, basically, I got in a bad habit subconsciously.
Teeth are designed for chewing, for phonetics, to be able to speak correctly.
But they're not designed to be in contact with each other all the time. And that grinding caused some tiny fractures in my teeth. The first sign of that was temperature sensitivity.
It begins with cold, which is a good sign because that means that your nerve is alive and is feeling the sensation of the cold.
Great, but it made ice cream excruciating. Of course, I ate it anyway. Dr. LaGreca says the more I grind my teeth, the more I exercise the masseter muscle in my jaw. So it just keeps getting worse. One possible treatment is, I kid you not, Botox injections.
That's something that we typically think about aesthetics and wrinkles, but we never think about the potential of using a neuromodulator to take a muscle that is enlarged and bring it back into proper size.
A simpler solution often is just wearing a mouth guard at night, which, to be fair, is something Dr. Al-Aswad told me to get months ago. The custom ones cost hundreds of dollars, even with dental insurance, so I decided to get one at the pharmacy, which probably would have helped if I'd ever used it. I did own up to that with my dentist.
You did tell me to get a night guard for this, and I bought one but never used it. Now I will.
Ideally, we want to have you wear a custom-made one.
Yeah.
But because you're kind of reluctant about the custom-made one right now, so I said try the one over the counter for the time being.
Yeah.
I'm happy to report the mouth guard is working, and I think I'm going to pass on the Botox injections.
That's Craig LaMolt with Connecting the Commonwealth, and that wraps up the News Roundup for this week. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.